So, Lucy, my good buddy, known Lucy for a long time. Lucy began working in social care over 30 years ago, and she was a volunteer working with homeless people in the Simon community in London. And then for over 20 years, she worked in the drug and alcohol sector in the NHS, but also for charities as well. And until May last year, she was the chief exec of EDP Drug and Alcohol Services, a regional-based charity working with people with substance misuse problems in communities, but also in prisons across the southwest, particularly Devon and Dorset. And if you think about it, that includes, Dartmoor, Channings Wood, the Verne. So some significant stuff there. And during Lucy's tenure, charity grew from a turnover of less than 1 million and 33 staff to over 9 million and 250 staff. So, although Lucy originally trained as a social worker and a counsellor, she now has an MBA specialising in leadership, and she works as a freelance consultant and coach. And actually, she's been quite modest in terms of this bio, because I know she is a fellow at the University of Exeter Centre for Leadership Study. So I think you're being a bit modest there, but there we go. So over to you, Lucy, and I'll monitor the chat function and we'll go from there.
Great, thank you. And hello, everybody. Really great to see you. Although I'll have to flick across the screen to see you all, but it's great that so many people have come to the talk this afternoon. And thanks for inviting me, Judith, and thanks to the Advocacy Project for inviting me. So I want to begin today by telling you some stories, because thinking about what lies behind problematic drug and alcohol use, essentially what lies behind it are people, and what lies behind those people are stories. And I always find it really helpful to remember some of the stories. And in the context of what I'm going to say afterwards, I think it would be helpful for us to remember some of these individual stories. So I'm going to start by talking about Dion. These are all true stories. They're all actually in the public domain. And they're all people who are in recovery. So what Dion says is, one of my earliest memories is from when I was about 3 years old. My mum was passed out drunk on the couch. I was tugging on her shirt and crying because I was hungry. I sat next to her all night long, still hopeful that she'd wake up and make my dinner for me. Life at home could get really crazy. Yelling and sometimes police sirens would wake me up. My mum's boyfriend would hit her or hit me for any little thing. As I got older, I mostly hung out on the streets. I started drinking when I was 10. At first, it was just because my friends dared me, and it was easy enough to steal a bottle from my mum. But then I liked how drinking made me forget my problems. After a while, I got into harder drugs, especially heroin. I dropped out of school. I dropped out of life. And then Donna, I've smoked cannabis since I was 17. I guess I enjoyed it at first. It just became a habit, like smoking cigarettes. I always had a rebellious streak in me. I think that stems from being abused by my dad when I was younger. My mum didn't want to know about the abuse and swept it under the carpet until eventually she listened. And we had to go to court over it. On the way to court, I found out that he was not my real dad, but my stepdad. My real dad had died many years ago. The only person I could ever talk about it to was my grandma, though I didn't as time went by. My stepdad died of alcohol on the same day my daughter was born. Grandma died 3.5 years later. I started drinking 1.5 years after my daughter was born. It got silly and out of hand to the point of drinking a liter of whiskey every day. I'd lost a lot of weight and generally wasn't happy with life. I started to neglect myself and my daughter. Friends and family were concerned about my health, and I ended up being referred to hospital. I was told that I didn't have a problem because I only drank whiskey. It wasn't until my husband left with my daughter that I actually realised just how bad things had got, and I stopped drinking. One day I couldn't get hold of any cannabis, so a mate of mine said they'd get some heroin. I thought, okay, because I'd tried it before and I was okay with it, I'll get some until I can get some more cannabis. After 4 months, I was addicted. Tracy, I'm an ordinary person with an extraordinary story. My descent into addiction began as a teenager after I'd been given opiates for a wisdom teeth extraction. I never realised something as small as a pill could have such huge effects on my life. Opiates were the solutions I'd been looking for, all in one place. When I took opiates, all my problems seemed to melt away. All my troubles disappeared in that moment. I went on chasing that feeling for the next 10 years. I was a promising student full of great expectations, yet I was never satisfied with how I felt in my own skin. This is a very common thread that unites many users. Finding temporary relief from depression, anxiety, or fear is a normal reaction when using drugs. Unfortunately, over time, the solution becomes a growing problem. While many users never get to the place I went, the feelings are the same. There is an overwhelming feeling that there's no escape. The task of quitting seems insurmountable. The pain of daily use slowly wrings the joy out of life to a point where an all-consuming painful habit dictates your thoughts and feelings. And then lastly, Michael. I started drinking the same time as many people, I guess. I'd left school, got a job, and had a bit of money at the weekends. All my mates drank, so it was normal, wasn't it? Looking back even then, I remember latching on to the one or two who were going elsewhere to carry on drinking when the rest were going home. One night after arriving drunk home, my mum said to me, "You need to go to AA and get help." I know at the time it was a bit of a joke. She doesn't remember saying it now. I never did go, never thought I needed to. Never thought that 20 years later, alcohol would bring me to my knees. Looking back, I can't complain about my upbringing. I had a normal home life like everyone else. I knew mum and dad were always happy, never argued, didn't drink, didn't smoke, and both worked hard. Drinking always seemed to make me more comfortable around other people. I was relaxed, no anxiety, especially when going around town. I was scared stiff of violence and fighting. I think mainly because I was bullied at school. There's an invisible line you cross from being a heavy drinker to becoming addicted, and I don't know when I crossed that line. I was always the pisshead whenever I was out with friends. I would be the one who had to go to a nightclub when others were heading home. I was always the last one at the bar. I met all my girlfriends through drink and later my wife. Surprise, surprise, she was a drinker and had her own issues about her past. We got into the habit of persuading one another that we'd both have a drink in the evenings after work. It got to the point where we were both buying booze on the way home, just to be sure we had enough in the house. Either way, we both felt better having a drink. But my wife's drinking got worse. She'd get aggressive and I'd get silly and daft. She'd want to fight and argue all the time. I got to the point of not wanting to come home after work. And when I did, I'd just head for the drink to ease my anxiety. Our drinking got worse and we divorced. I was left lonely, renting a small flat, and found I couldn't stop drinking. I was severely depressed at this stage. Work started to suffer and I was drinking more than ever. I visited my GP to try and get help. She was more interested in the fact that I smelt of alcohol and I was driving than trying to help me. I left feeling ashamed and worried that the police would be waiting for me around the corner. I carried on drinking for another 2 years until eventually I lost my job. Think what you can take from those stories, and really what I take from stories that I've heard from people, many, many stories over the years, is there's two main reasons why people use drink and use drug. One, because of how it makes them feel, and two, because of how it stops them from feeling. how it numbs out the feelings that people don't want to feel. And one way to understand what different drugs look like is to look at how they're classified. So what are the categories and groups that they're put into? And one of the classifications is about the impact that different drugs have on the central nervous system. So there's four main classifications, and they're stimulant, depressant, hallucinogen, and painkiller. So a stimulant tends to speed up the activity of a person's nervous system, including the brain. And stimulant drugs often result in people feeling more alert and more energetic. And examples of stimulants are amphetamines, cocaine, nicotine, and caffeine. And then depressants tend to slow down the activity of the nervous system, often resulting in people feeling more relaxed and sleepy. And it's quite important to note that the term depressant is used to describe the effect on the nervous system and not the mood. So a really good example is alcohol. People don't think about alcohol as a depressant because often it makes them feel more euphoric. But it makes them feel more euphoric because it's depressing the inhibitions and it's depressing other feelings. But its primary effect on the nervous system is to depress the nervous system. So other examples of depressants as well as alcohol are what are called benzodiazepines, so things like diazepam, which is called Valium, and temazepam, and things like glue and petrol and paint. And then hallucinogens have the ability to alter how people are perceiving things. So they change the messages that are carried in the central nervous system. And a common example is LSD and also magic mushrooms. And then painkillers, and painkillers are also depressants, but that their primary effect or the main experience that people have is that it takes away all pain. So the best example of a painkiller is diamorphine, which you've probably heard about if you've been in hospital or known somebody in hospital, because it's the painkiller that's given to people. And diamorphine is...
Callum, can you go on,
carry on,
please? Yeah, carry on, Lucy.
So diamorphine is actually pure heroin. So heroin is diamorphine in a pure form. And the thing that's important to know about heroin is it not only stops people feeling physical pain, but it stops people feeling psychological pain as well. And that's really the reason why people, in the story that we heard, why people keep chasing that feeling. They keep chasing that first heroin high and the ability that heroin has to stop them feeling any sort of pain. So I'm going to... I just need to try and go down. Oh, here you go. So in 1948, a pharmacologist called Peter Witt did some experiments where he gave small amounts of drugs to spiders. And he was actually looking at how often a spider would spin their web and what time the spider would spin their web. But what was really interesting and what came out of it was the sort of webs that the spiders spun as a result of taking these drugs. So I'm just going to ask you to whether you can say in the chat, if we go from left to right, 1, 2, 3, 4, what drugs do you think the spiders had taken to spin these webs? So for the first one on the left, anybody got any idea of what drug that might be that would cause a spider to spin that sort of web?
So we've got several here, Lucy.
Yeah.
We've got depressant, we've got painkiller, we've got cannabis, we've got alcohol.
Okay, so it's cannabis. is that first one. I think it's quite interesting how it's just sort of a bit unfinished, isn't it? It's just sort of half done. What about the second one?
So second one, we've got heroin, alcohol, caffeine, hallucinogenic.
Okay, so the second one is a type of amphetamine. And then the third one?
Cocaine, we've got.
Yeah, that third one is.
Coke, stimulant.
Third one is actually a sleeping drug.
Interestingly. Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
That's not how people are seeing it.
No, because it looks quite busy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So what about the last
one? You've got people saying, wow, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah, alcohol.
Any more?
Painkiller. The third one is so intricate, busy and fizzy. Last one, hallucinogenic. Last one, weed, heroin, LSD. Yeah.
Okay. So the last one is caffeine.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? So, just like completely unfocused.
Somebody
just said, oh blimey, I'm giving up coffee.
So how many people have had a cup of coffee today? Just put your hands up.
Yeah, quite a lot.
And how many people drink a bit more coffee than they think they should? A few hands. And how many people eat a bit more than they think they should, or eat too much chocolate? Yeah, definitely some people there. And how many people spend more time on their phones than they think they should? Looking at social media, lots of hands there. I think it's just useful to think about, you know, why do we do these things? Why do we do these things that we know aren't good for us? And I think, again, we do those things because they make us feel good in the short term, or, again, they stop us from feeling things. They're a way of us just numbing ourselves out from other feelings. And I think it's also interesting to ask ourselves, how confident are we that we wouldn't become dependent on these activities if our lives got very difficult? And over the years, I've listened to many stories of people who have or have had problems with drugs and alcohol. And when I really listen, and when I get to know these people, I can understand why they've ended up with those problems. And I more think there, but for the grace of God, go I. So I've got another picture. Does anyone know who that is?
Nah.
Maybe. This is Michael Phelps, who's an Olympic record breaker.
Some people saying Michael Phelps.
Oh, okay, well done.
Somebody's saying Tom Cruise, but no, Michael Phelps, clearly.
It's a bit like Tom Cruise.
Nah.
Michael Phelps, so he won 28 Olympic medals. Mm. And fairly recently, he came out saying that he'd suffered a lot in terms of his mental health. He'd been very depressed, and particularly after the Olympics, so after he'd been involved in a lot of activity, he could get very depressed and very poorly, and had suicidal thoughts. And he said that he tried to escape his depression by using drugs. And like Michael Phelps, lots of people have both drug and alcohol and mental health issues. So between a third and half of the people who use mental health services also have had drug and alcohol problems at some time in their lives. And 75% of drug service and 85% of alcohol service patients have had a past psychiatric disorder. So it's really common for people to have both mental health issues and drug and alcohol issues. And research suggests that either one can lead to another. So there's lots of ways in which that could happen. So, you know, firstly, people might use drugs in order to get relief from their mental health issues. So like Michael Phelps did, he was depressed and he used drugs in order to relieve some of those feelings. But the temporary relief usually creates other problems. But drug use in itself can also lead to mental health problems. So research has shown that some people who use marijuana have an increased risk of psychosis. And also, using drugs can lead to depression and anxiety when the effects wear off. I mean, particularly with stimulant drugs. So you get that really big high, but you get a corresponding low. And people can get very depressed after using stimulant drugs. And drinking and drug use can also aggravate or exacerbate, they can make worse an existing mental health problem. And also when people are withdrawing from drink and drugs, that can mimic, it can feel, it can be like some of the symptoms that you'd see for mental health issues. So it's called dual diagnosis. You've probably heard of dual diagnosis, where people have both a mental health and a drug or alcohol problem. It's also sometimes called dual disorder or comorbidity. And there's quite a preoccupation about what's the main problem, which is the problem that came first. Is it that somebody had a drug or alcohol problem, or is it because they've got a mental health problem? And although services sometimes might need to look into that, it's sometimes not been all that helpful for people who have dual diagnosis, when services are a bit preoccupied with which has come first, because they can end up going between different services and nobody really looking at, you know, the whole of their problem and the whole of that person. And also, lots of people don't just have a drug and alcohol problem and don't just have a mental health problem. They have lots of different problems. So this thing about, you know, going to one service where people are focusing on your mental health issue, or going to another service where people are focusing on the drug or alcohol issue, isn't necessarily that helpful. It's more helpful to look at the whole of what somebody's struggling with. And it's really important that people, that services work together. And I think there's a lot more recognition of that. And dual diagnosis is really common in prisons. So 9 out of 10 people in prison have a mental health or substance abuse problem. Often have both, and it's much better where the health services in the prisons have a more integrated approach, where they treat both those things and they look at the whole person. And some health services in prisons are quite good at doing that, but some are a lot more fragmented, where you've got people seeing those two different services and they're not really working very closely together. So I want to move on and talk about stigma. And I think it's useful again for us to think ourselves how stigma affects us. So how do we feel when we feel misjudged by other people? And how do we feel when we feel really seen and really heard by other people? Probably all of us can remember somebody in our life who really, really valued us. And I guess that's the opposite of where you're stigmatized and where you're really misjudged and not recognized by people. And I think that there's a lot of stigma, particularly with drug users. There's a lot of labels. If you ever look at any article about drug users, quite often in the comments below, it's these sort of words. This is the way people talk about drug users. And it's quite clear that drug users are a very highly stigmatized group. And I think what the thing that can happen with this is that people forget about the rest of that person. They just see them. It's been talked about as a master status if you're a drug user. People just see you as a drug user. They forget that you're a person, as in the stories we heard, and you've got your own story. And it can really affect the interactions that people have, and also the way in which they're treated by services. And people can often feel a lot of disgust and anger and judgment. One of the places where drug users come into contact a lot with the general public, and where their worlds sort of collide with the world of the general public, is in a pharmacy. So a lot of drug users, heroin users, go to pharmacies in order to get clean needles and syringes, and also to get their methadone. So methadone is a drug that's prescribed as part of the treatment for people who are dependent on heroin. And the pharmacist is a really important person, because the pharmacist might be the only person that person sees. And the pharmacist can have a really good relationship and chat to that person, can look out for them and see how they are, might be able to suggest other services that they might go to. And I'm really aware of this relationship with the pharmacist, having worked in drug and alcohol services for a long time. Whenever I'm in a pharmacy and somebody comes in to fill up their methadone or to get some needles, I'm sort of hyper-vigilant about what happens. And I always look out for what happens. And I notice when a pharmacist chats and is friendly, and it warms my heart to see that somebody is getting that interaction, which they probably really desperately need. But I also notice when sometimes there's a sort of tangible change in the atmosphere, and you know, the pharmacy staff start looking around and looking suspicious, and the way in which people are talked to is not particularly friendly and not particularly trusting. And I was once at a conference where two ex-heroin users stood up and talked about the one pharmacist that they both could still remember, who used to look them in the eye and talk to them. And it was a really important thing for them. So I'm just going to make a confession that I took my title from a great publication that I read in 2010, and it was called Sinning and Sinned Against. I just thought it was a great title, so I stole my title from that. I changed it very slightly.
You didn't admit to that.
No.
Yeah, great title.
Yeah, so that was, it was published by the Royal Society of Arts, and it was written by somebody called Charlie Lowe from the University of York. And they looked at stigma, particularly with drug users, and the impact of stigma. And they looked at the research around people using pharmacies, and lots of drug users talked about how difficult that could be and how it impacted on their desire to go back to the pharmacy and how they felt about themselves. And one thing that was really interesting was one bit of research looked at stealing, because obviously that's an issue about stealing from a pharmacy. But a key factor here was that a lot of drug users reported that when they felt treated well by pharmacy staff, they felt obliged not to steal. And when staff were rude to them, they were much more tempted to steal. So it was a really interesting piece of research. And it also talks about, in this publication, about negative reactions towards drug users, particularly in hospitals, where drug users are frequently made to feel that they're wasting valuable resources and are treated differently from other people. And also they talk quite a lot about homelessness services and how drug users often felt they were given low priority, and people were sort of hostile and negative towards them. I'm just going to show you another picture. So this is a woman who's pregnant, who's smoking. And I want you to just try and think about how do you feel when you see a woman who's pregnant and smoking? How do you feel if you saw a picture of a woman pregnant and drinking a bottle of whiskey? How would you feel if you saw a picture of a woman pregnant and injecting heroin? I think people do have a lot of feelings. It does evoke some quite strong feelings in lots of people. I think that's very common. And I think it's important that we're honest about our responses and our judgment. But at the same time, we need to understand the impact it has on a woman and on her situation if they feel that they're being judged, and if we let our feelings and judgments, if we have them, impact on our behaviour. I've worked with a lot of women who are pregnant and using drugs and drinking. I've never met a woman who feels good about it. I've never met a woman who doesn't want to do something about it. But I have met many women who don't want to access maternity services because they're frightened that they're going to be judged, and they're frightened that their children are going to be taken away from them. And yet the research consistently tells us that the thing that will impact most on the outcome of the pregnancy when a woman is using drugs and drinking, the thing that will make the biggest difference is whether or not the woman accesses maternity services. So accessing maternity services can make a huge difference on outcomes and the baby being well and the mother being well. But lots of women are very frightened of accessing services. I think it is quite often really good when hospitals have specialist midwives, because they're midwives who really know about what the issues are and have a lot of compassion towards that issue. And I think that can be very helpful. But there's a lot of research that suggests that female problem drug users may be more stigmatised than males, and particularly if they're mothers or mothers-to-be. Mm. And there was a piece of research that looked at where a group of women in New York City, they felt there were multiple discriminations that they were having, that they were subject to. So it was a group of over 1,000 Black and Latino substance users. And they found that 79% and 70% of them, respectively, the Black one 79 and the Latino 70%, reported experiencing discrimination on account of their drug use. 40% of them said they were discriminated against because they'd been in prison. And 39% of the Black group and 23% of the Latino group said that they'd been discriminated against because of race. And when they were asked about where the drug-related discrimination was experienced, they most often referred to the police, but they also talked about friends and employers and family. But the most significant discrimination there was the drug use. So those women suffered multiple discrimination, and most significantly the drug use. And there's also been research about the experience of stigma of people who have hepatitis C, who often will talk about themselves in terms of being dirty. So there's some quotes in this publication where one interviewee said, "When I'm around the mums group and all those clean sort of people, and sometimes even around alcoholics that didn't touch drugs, I just feel a bit dirty." And another woman said, "I was supposed to have lots of baths when I was in hospital, and the nurse came in and in no uncertain terms told me I wasn't allowed to use the bath. And she was just really unpleasant because I was a dirty junkie who had hepatitis C, and she thought that I would scum up the bath for someone else." There's also been studies showing that it's really hard for people to get back to working lives because of discrimination. And there was one study that talked to 20 employers who were really worried about things like whether they could trust people, whether people would come to work, how they would impact on other workers. But when those employers were asked about drug users they'd actually employed in the past, most employers felt that they'd done really well and they'd got on really well with their colleagues. I guess another thing that is stigmatizing for people is just going to a drug and alcohol service. So where people are wanting to have a different sort of life, they can feel that going to that service in itself can be quite stigmatizing. And there's been a lot of arguments for making services more mainstream and making them more mainstream sort of medical services rather than seen as more sort of criminal justice services. But I think an overly medical model, which looks at addiction in terms of a disease, can also sometimes not pay enough attention to psychological and social issues. And it can also overly sort of pathologize and make people feel more of a problem, as well as sometimes being really helpful. I've worked quite a lot in the health service, and I've met lots of very, very skilled and compassionate people who've been great with working with people with drug and alcohol problems. But I've also experienced medical staff who I felt let clever diagnoses and labels get in the way of seeing that person as a whole person, and seeing that person as another human being who just ended up in a different situation to the one that they're in. What the publication about stigma argued was that what really needs to be challenged is the widespread sense that problem drug users have only got themselves to blame for their situation. And yet it seems that problem drug and alcohol use is a combination of genetic factors, what we're born with, and environmental factors, what happens to us. So how can we really blame people for what happened to them? How can we blame that boy who at three sat up all night waiting for his mother to give him a meal? How can we blame the fact that he ended up drinking to make himself feel better? And it's also important to recognise that people with drug and alcohol problems do often have a wide range of problems, and they all need to be looked at. And again, that's the importance of seeing the person and listening to their story rather than just looking at that one label that might be the service that you're in. So just lastly, just say a little bit, because I know not a lot of time, just say a little bit about UK drugs policy. A few things about UK drugs policy. It's the responsibility of the Home Office. So the approach taken is very much a criminal justice rather than a health focused approach. And well over half, probably two thirds of people in prison in the UK are dependent on drugs and alcohol. Most resources are spent on tackling supply as opposed to treatment, and treatment services have seen a reduction in funding of about 27% in the last few years. And yet in the United Kingdom, and particularly in Scotland, we have amongst the highest drug death rates in Europe. And in October of last year, the Health Committee of MPs published a report calling for a radical change of the drugs policy. They said it was failing. And these are some of the recommendations that they made. They're still awaiting a response. They recommended that we should change from a criminal justice to a health approach, that the responsibility should move from the Home Office to the Department of Health and Social Care, that the government should consult on decriminalising drug possession for personal use, so to make that a civil matter rather than a criminal offence. And they said they should look at the Portuguese system, where it isn't a criminal offence to have drugs for possession. And they've improved treatment services and introduced a lot of harm reduction interventions. And they've got better education, prevention, and social support. They said that we should have more needle and syringe programs. We should have drug consumption rooms. And they said all these things could play an important role in preventing deaths amongst drug users. And also, if there was less money in the criminal justice system, we could redirect that towards treatment. So in conclusion, are people with drug and alcohol problems sinners? Are they to blame for their dependence, or are they in some way sinned against, victims of their own genetic makeup and the particular environment in which they've needed to navigate their lives? I have to always come back to the stories, to the people, to Dion, Donna, Tracy and Michael. And I don't support the idea that people like them are to blame. It seems to me that drugs and alcohol problems are caused by a mix of what we're born with and what happens to us. And I think it's really important that we stop blaming and stigmatizing people for it, because it makes it really difficult for people to get help. I also don't think that the public policy which makes drug users criminals serves them or addresses all the problems that are caused in our communities by drug and alcohol use. And in my mind, they all deserve more compassion and more support from us all. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. God bless you, Lucy. That was amazing. Thank you. So we've got quite a lot of questions on the chat function. So, yeah. So, sorry, just finding them all because there's so many, because we've got so many people on the call. But there's things about what's acceptable versus unacceptable. Self-medicating, you know, alcohol, Wetherspoons, cheap cider, yeah. What's acceptable versus what isn't?
Yeah, well, yeah. Big question, I guess. I mean, I think what's interesting is what's culturally acceptable. So, you know, if you look across the world at all drugs apart from crack, I think, have been legal somewhere at some time in history. And there's, you know, if you think about alcohol and the prohibition, and alcohol hasn't always been legal. So it's very interesting about, I guess there's a, I think what's acceptable is very determined by when we live and the sort of culture that we live in. Alcohol does, you know, it is a very, very dangerous drug and does a lot of damage. And yet, it, you know, it's widely accepted in this country. And
less pervasive, less difficult, less problematic. Yeah, so Faye saying is, why is perception heavier alcohol drinkers fine, social drinking not a problem, yet drug taking is a problem?
Well, again, I think it's quite culturally determined, and you know, if you look at the context of, you know, the government receive a lot of money from the drinks industry, and you know some people would argue, well, that's a big reason why not much is done about that. But I mean, I suppose the other side of it is the criminal side of it. So, you know, people who are using drugs will often commit crime, acquisitive crime, in order to fund their drug habit.
Yeah, acquisitive crime is a real thing, isn't it? Yeah.
So I guess that also will impact a lot on how people are seeing.
So from several people on the chat function, they're saying, but what about personal responsibility?
Well, I don't think that's, I'm not saying that's not relevant. And I think, you know, when people are coming to try and get help for drug and alcohol problems, they do have a lot of personal responsibility. I just believe that people are up against so much. People who've got really entrenched in drug and alcohol issues are up against so much that, yes, they do need to take some responsibility, but they need a lot of support to help them do that.
Yeah. So moving on from that, or further developing that, there's several questions about mental capacity in substance misuse.
Yeah. Well, that is a big issue that, you know, there are a lot of people who are quite vulnerable as well in terms of, you know, that people are quite often targeted in, you know, by dealers and are quite vulnerable to getting problems because maybe they haven't got the mental capacity in order to make good decisions. So it is something that services do need to be aware of. And it's very tricky, I guess, if...
Does that relate to cuckooing?
Well, I think it can do, can't it? I think, you know, the whole sort of county lines and, you know, young people, you know, very young, vulnerable people, you know, becoming sort of prey to dealers and,
Wow. We've got, probably 50 things in the chat. So we're not going to do them all before 3 o'clock, but we've got things like gateway drugs.
Yeah, interesting one. I think, because I know that a lot of people will say that cannabis can lead to heroin. Mm-hmm. There's not actually a lot of evidence to say that's true. Although a lot of heroin users have used cannabis, there's lots of cannabis users who don't use heroin. I think it's more, I would say that developing problems are more about, you know, the sort of life that people are leading and, you know, the sort of risks that they're up against and the way, you know, their ability to and resilience to deal with difficult issues. I don't think it's about whether they've used a particular gateway drug.
Yeah, okay. So a really interesting one here. Personal responsibility is a luxury. If you've been battered by life, it's not easy to afford, personal responsibility.
Yeah, well, I agree, absolutely. I think people need a lot of compassion, to be able to develop more sort of self-esteem and more resilience to start to be able to take that personal responsibility. It just feels it's too easy to talk about personal responsibility if somebody is so battered and potentially quite traumatized.
Clicking my way through all these questions. So interesting one here. Any suggestions for challenging the chicken and egg mentality for dual diagnosis? It can be a barrier to receiving Care Act assessments and other services.
Yeah, I've worked in a number of areas and I've never worked anywhere where it's not an issue. It's really about services working more together, and it can come down to individual workers as well. I would just be persistent. I mean it's clear that if somebody has a sort of severe and enduring mental health issue, then that, you know, their care does need to be led by mental health services. So if somebody has quite a serious mental health issue, I don't think there's any get out clause for mental health services. I think where it becomes more tricky is where somebody's got more sort of low level mental health issues. But where somebody really does need an assessment, mental health services do have that responsibility.
Yeah.
And often there's a dual diagnosis strategy which you could try and get hold of, which will say who has the responsibility. Who takes lead responsibility in different scenarios. So that's also worth looking out for.
So somebody who's referring here to the NICE policy, it's everyone's job. There should be no exclusion criteria. Substance misuse should not be a barrier to receiving services.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, there are some really good, nice guidelines that were updated in 2017, which about drug dependence, which are pretty much the Bible, really, in terms of, what the different options are and what helps with different types of problems. It's quite a dense, heavy read, but it's worth referring to if you're stuck on something.
Yeah, and a COVID one here, COVID-related substance misuse, and I've not seen this myself, I've not seen the research on this myself, but during COVID, substance misuse admissions were a lot less.
I don't actually know about that.
No.
But I think there is some interesting There's an organisation called Collective Voice, which is a group of substance misuse organisations. They've just published, they just brought together all the stuff that's been published COVID related about the experience of drug and alcohol users during COVID. And it's been some interesting things. I haven't read it all, but I had a quick look at it. And, you know, there were some interesting things about people feeling like they were trusted more because they were able to take their medication home, and you know, they didn't have to jump through so many barriers. So it's not all been negative, even though it's been really difficult for some people.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So another one here, Sarah Joy. So it's the average person, in quotes, because of lockdown, has the substance misuse found a different outlet, whether food, obesity, or whatever?
There's an evidence review that's been published, and people have definitely been drinking more during lockdown. And some people eating more as well. It's just it's not been great for a lot of people's health, really.
Yeah. and a really interesting one here, we're coming close to time, but from Mark, how can research and fact-based support counter the Daily Mail?
It's a bit of a million-dollar question, I think. Anyone's got an answer?
3 minutes to answer. Yeah.
I always think stories are good. You know, whenever I went to talk to people, I always took somebody with me who could tell their story. And I definitely, I like the Cancel the Mail. I definitely have seen people change their mind having heard a story, particularly maybe from somebody who, you know, just they wouldn't, not your stereotypical sort of drug or alcohol user, because, you know, I may be talking a little bit stereotypically, you know, about some of the people that you all might work with, but there's lots of people with drug and alcohol problems, and it's not always who you think.
It's all of us.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's interesting. So one more question. Oh, substance misuse psychiatric admissions in the place that this person works have gone up by 50%.
Wow.
Is there anything you can, you know, add to that?
What, I didn't know that. Is that during this? Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, there's a lot of concern about mental health, isn't there? And the whole lockdown thing has just exacerbated a lot of inequalities. So, you know, people who've got a lot of things to contend with, it sort of makes sense, but I didn't know that statistic. Thank you.
Yeah. And one final one, methadone costs under lockdown gone up threefold. So somebody saying it's a money spinner, sinned against, and I think that's really interesting. Yeah, so we've got one more minute. Blame, shame, stigma prevents recovery, compassion. And thank you so much for the talk that you've given. So is anything you want to say about blame or stigma?
Oh, well, just it's so easy for all of us, isn't it, to other anyone, where I think often it's because we feel afraid. It's just easier to make somebody into something else and forget that it's another human. We probably all do it on some level. And I guess it's just something for us all to be careful about.
Yeah, for sure. But we've got so many questions, Lucy. There's probably about 20 questions that I've not had a chance to put to you. And we're now on 3 o'clock. So Perhaps we can work with you afterwards, get your view on the questions that come in on the chat function. We can
put out a
document together with your slides. That would be fab.
Yeah.
Okay.
All the thank yous. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Hope it was useful.
Oh, no, fantastic. I mean, I can see from the chat function how much everyone's really enjoyed it.